Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, Maria. How are you doing?
I'm good, Cheryl. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Maria, for coming on the New Books Network to talk about, as we were saying before we started recording this conversation, such an incredible book, which really is in some ways sure to become a classic in many fields, and it raises such important questions, and I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Maria, we have a tradition on the New Books Network that our first question is always biographical. So I was wondering if you could share a bit with our listeners your story, your journey as a scholar, how you became a scholar, and then how you got to write this particular book.
Okay, thank you. So thank you for those words about the book. As you can well imagine, I think this is true for most scholars or most authors. The path to the book or to scholarly research has not been very linear for me. It's been fairly convoluted. I've been a women's rights activist and a gender practitioner for about 20 years in Pakistan, working on issues of violence and masculinities. And so around 2012, which is when I was searching for a project for my PhD, something happened which made me think about the topic of the book itself. In 2012, as you may be aware, there was this massive avalanche in the Gyari sector in Siachen, on Siachen Glacier. And this was like, for those listeners who may not be familiar with Pakistan's history, the Siachen Glacier is like the highest battleground on earth, where we have Indian and Pakistani troops positioned across from each other, very close to each other, but positioned on this glacier, which is in the northern parts of Kashmir. It goes up as high as between 4,000 to 6,000 meters. And so in this terrain, we have soldiers positioned, and 70% of soldier deaths in this area are largely due to climatic conditions. So when this avalanche happened, within a few minutes, we lost about 150 soldiers. So this was a massive event, a massive tragedy, of course. And so what interested me at that point was, what was fascinating to watch was that for me, the question of why are we even there, and what the futility of fighting for a terrain which is largely inhospitable. So those questions were completely sidestepped in this outpouring of sympathy and solidarity with the families of the Shuhada, and then this almost sort of fascination and glorifying sort of narratives of sacrifice of these men. So that sort of got me. I was just very fascinated as to how that was the main. The public discourse was more around these issues and not questioning the war effort itself. So my question sort of emerged from this period where it was like, how are these narratives of sacrifice even made possible in these particular situations, when it's glaringly obvious that the war itself, the conflict itself on this particular border needs to be questioned. So that's how my interest in this issue came about. So it was just that particular incident which was it just left an impact, and I just wanted to explore that more.
Terrific. So perhaps we could start with a broad question, and perhaps I could have you reflect a bit on the title of the book, which is Dying to Serve, which tries to sort of capture its key theme of this, as you were just talking about, this kind of a contradictory practice of self-sacrifice that this book tries to look at. So I was wondering if you could speak a bit about that, and if you could tag along this general sort of main argument of the book with what I found to be a really brilliant meditation throughout the book, which is, of course, the theoretical intervention that you make in terms of the category of affect. And really, this book is a tremendous a study of how affect is regulated, how it's managed by a certain kind of a sovereign power for its own means and ends. So I was wondering if you could just perhaps combine those two threads, the main argument of the book as it is connected to the title, and then why is this category of affect so central to your conceptual intervention?
Sure. So I think, so with reference to the title of the book itself, I think what I'm trying to put across to somebody who's sort of, who looks at the book is this idea, one is this, of course, the play on the word dying itself. So there's this longing for service, right? So Pakistan Army continues to be an all-volunteer force. It's never had to resort to conscription, despite the fact that it has, you know, it has had four cross-border wars with India, several counterinsurgency operations within the country. And despite that, we do have large numbers of people wanting to, desiring service in the army. So one is this, and then it's the kind of service which within the job contract is this caveat, which is that it can ask you to kill or it can ask you to die for it. And so that for me, I mean, I think I'm trying to capture this contradiction as you mentioned a little bit earlier, which is this longing and this desire for service, which can result in death. So it's almost a longing for death. So that's what I wanted to bring out in a somewhat dramatic way, as most of us, when we're trying to look for titles for our books, we try and do. So that's the idea behind it. So your second part of your question, which is around affect, affect was very central to the lens that I've used in the book, and as you rightly picked up. It might seem strange, but when I started working on the project, I wasn't necessarily at that point the critical sort of role that this was going to play in my analysis wasn't that clear to me. And this happened literally as I went along and deeper into my research itself. And it's because, one, I think because the experience that I've sought to sort of study or to capture is a deeply, deeply affective one. So we are talking about the deaths of sons and husbands, which is intensely painful. So I think that is something you can't escape from almost. So that's the substance of the book. So I think, so for me, in a very simple way, affect had to stay central. And secondly, and much more importantly, I suppose, the fact that it's impossible to really understand how these narratives are made possible because the military itself deploys them so centrally in their imagery, in their messaging. So again, this was something that came up not just in my conversations with families, this came up, and soldiers, this also came up within the military representations of the sacrifice very clearly. So it wasn't a lens that I could actually even avoid. And it also, I think for me, is central because, and I hope you'll talk more about that as we move along, is that it's a very useful lens because it allows me to make sense almost of the ambivalences and the disconnects sometimes that lie under very seemingly complicit narratives of soldiers and families. So this lens really helped me understand what the subject of my inquiry. I don't think I can do it justice. I could have done it justice if I hadn't adopted this lens. So it kind of found me before I started looking for it.
So before we get into the sort of specific thematics and chapters of the book, I was wondering perhaps we could, for the benefit of the listeners, provide some kind of a broad overview of the landscape, so to say, that this book interrogates by doing two things. If I could have you talk a bit about the Pakistani military a bit, its sort of history and its intimate interconnections with the British, Indian Army and the colonial context. And then if I could have you speak a bit about the primary site of your inquiry, which is Chakwal in the province of Punjab in Pakistan. Could you perhaps introduce to our listeners a bit some key features of Chakwal, and then perhaps a little bit also about your own positionality in relation to your interlocutors and those who make the constitute the subjects for the study.
Okay. I think in terms of the setting of context of the Pakistan military, I think very, very quickly, for much of Pakistan's existence, the military has been either directly in power or has been in power in behind the scenes in terms of dominance of our foreign policy, in terms of dominance of our budgets, and so on and so forth. So it's a very central institution within Pakistan. So that's very, very briefly, if I have to give a context to the military, there's much more that needs to be said, but I'll move from that. So Chakwal itself was erstwhile part of the Jhelum district during the times of British India. And it was a key recruitment area for the military, for the British Indian Army, so to speak. And as were certain other areas which lie alongside it, along the Potowar belt, which is Attock, Rawalpindi, and certain districts in KP as well. And this was what were called the Marshall Belt, where the British Indian Army drew upon its for its army for a host of reasons, which I won't go into, but I do speak about it in depth in the book. And these areas are what are called Barani, they're rain-fed areas. These areas, the land terrain in these areas is uneven, it's rocky, it's not suitable for cultivation, and those sections that are suitable have to rely on unpredictable rainfall. So agricultural, unlike the rest of Punjab, the reliance on agriculture tends to be somewhat problematic. So people from this belt, from these areas, have over many, many years sought services outside. In the times of the British, it was largely the military, British Indian Army itself. And over time now, for example, there's a lot of migrant labor to Gulf as well as to Saudi Arabia from these areas. So this is the area where the military, British Indian Army, drew troops from. And then subsequently, after partition, the Pakistan Army continued to draw troops from these areas, Chakwal being one of these districts. And what is called the reliance of the Pakistan Army on these areas is what is often referred to as the Marshall Race hangover, where it continued to draw upon these areas for military labor. And there's this whole sort of idea that people from these areas make better soldiers because they're more hardy, they're more valiant, they're more amenable to army discipline because there's been a generational investment in military service, and which to some extent is true. There's a cultural aspect to that, but very much so. This idea of being a martial race is very much embedded in the district itself when you talk to people. So that was the broader landscape of my study. Much of the soldier class that I've interviewed, the recruitment centers that I've visited, are based in the district of Chakwal. And just to give you an idea of what military service means to this area, in one of the villages where I was doing an ethnography, 60% of households within that had at least one member who were affiliated with the military. And this number is probably much higher because I had to rely upon post office records of pensions that were given out in the area. So it doesn't include serving soldiers. So it is probably higher than that. So that's the kind of space where my study is located. In terms of my own positionality that you mentioned, I think, of course, my gender and my class in many ways are two markers that are interesting to look at, because especially in the context of an ethnography, so how much do you really, what kind of spaces do you have access to, and how much are you really able to embed yourself in a certain milieu? So in some ways, I believe that my gender allowed and my class also allowed me to maybe be part of conversations that maybe I would not have been allowed to. be part of had I been too similar. So my lack of similarity to everybody around maybe helped in some ways. But in the same way, I did feel, so when it came to women, it allowed me access to spaces which helped. But in the case of men, it restricted me because obviously I could not, so to speak, hang around with men in the spaces that in a village setting where they would normally. So I was restricted in terms of my access to men, soldiers or fathers of deceased soldiers. So to basically interview settings. But with the women, I was I felt like I had access, much more access and much more room to just be with people. Also, I mentioned in the book that I myself have a military background. My father was a military officer. And in that way, that helped me connect, I think, and not in terms of the obvious sort of in the sense that I don't think it helped me connect that, you know, people felt maybe they could trust me better. That I don't think that was the issue. I think the reason I think it allowed me to connect was because I have been exposed to a certain kind of military ethos and military sensibilities and terminologies and some ways even discipline. I think I could resonate with the sense of, which I've, I think earlier mentioned, a sense of dissonance and a sense at the same time of affinity with military scripts. So I think that is something that I could resonate with, and I think that helped me connect better. So as always is the case, you know, certain markers of our own positionality help us, and certain, and I tried to be conscious of them as I went along. And there's no such thing as being completely objective, is there? So I tried to be conscious of that as I did my research, and I progressed in my work.
Wonderful. So in the beginning chapters of your book, you spend a lot of time talking about the way in which the military and its various exercises, how it tries to regulate the emotion of grief among soldiers, their families, after the death of soldiers and so on. And you particularly focus on these spectacles that are hosted by the military annually. What are known as the Defense Day or Yom-e-Difa, and then now has been morphed into this day for the remembrance of the martyrs or Yadgar-e-Shahada, etc. And you do a very close reading of these events and try to show how they're staged and how they're regulated. But then you also show these interesting moments and points of fissure when the official script in some ways departs from the unfolding of such spectacles. So I was wondering if you could perhaps say a bit about this thematic, these spectacles and their official scripts, and how things don't always go according to those scripts.
Okay. So there's a chapter that I dedicate to this, which is a deconstruction of these large commemorative ceremonies that the military does. So again, to give it some more context, in 2010, the Pakistan Army declared April 30th as Yom-e-Shohada, which is Martyrs Day, to pay tribute to the soldiers who died in the war in the northwest of Pakistan as part of the larger war on terror. And since then, these Yom-e-Shohada commemorations have been held annually across all army garrisons, as well as a very large national commemorative ceremony that is held in the general headquarters in Rawalpindi, which is the heartland of the Pakistan military, and it's broadcast across the nation on state televisions and on private channels live. So what I do in the book, I think in chapter two, is basically deconstruct these master narratives. For me, these spectacles are very important because they kind of define and sort of give shape to this narrative that the military puts out and what it wants its citizens to perceive in terms of what the military's role is. And these performances valorize military service, they speak for the dead and their families, they construct the manly soldier and his family as willing nationalistic beings who will rally around, stand firm, and offer more despite their immense hardship and pain. So in this deconstructing this, I look at the script of these ceremonies and the scripts, which largely speak to discourses of kinship, gender, and religion, which are discourses which we know now is how the nationalist subject is often imagined. But what is more important in this chapter, for me at least, is the craft, which is not so much what is said, but it is how it is to be said. It is the creation of an ambience that is critical to the script being delivered, which is in which affect is deliberately produced and harnessed. These are very emotive performances. So we have testimonies of families, especially of the mother. And they're very, very heart-wrenching. They're very, very, very emotional to watch. So we'll often have the audience in tears while the mother comes on stage and talks about the death of her son. And the camera will capture this sort of transmission of affect from the mother to the audience, and it keeps going back and forth. It's very skillfully done. And so just to give you an example, so there's how these spectacles are then organized. So there's a fair amount of instruction that goes on backstage to ensure that the performance on stage is just right. It's not too much. There's not too much grief and there's not too little grief. It's just enough grief to invoke the kind of affect that is important, that the military deems important for it to set itself up as savior. So I call this a calculated dose of grief that has to be delivered. So this prep that happens, so I was talking to this, and I think I do speak about this in the book itself, this particular, so I was interviewing this major who writes the scripts and directs these events, and he spoke to me about this particular father who was obviously very grief-stricken, but some time had passed since the death, and he said that obviously this is and they're very conscious of a difficult process of how you can, you know, talk to the father, enable him to go on stage and not break down either. So, but also show enough emotion so that it can then have an effect on the rest of the audience and the larger citizenry that's watching on television. So the soldier, the major told me that, you know, it took him a fair amount of time to prep and prepare this testimony with the father, and he did a wonderful job. He went on stage and he was very poised, but yet he also was able to convey an immense amount of grief. And then he said, as the father turned back, he looked at me and he was in the wings at the back, and the father made a thumbs up sign. And so the major interestingly picks up on that in his conversation with me and said that this was an interesting moment because it sort of signified that what was happening on stage was not completely raw emotion. It was some amount of quote-unquote acting, which is a harsh word to use because these are very, very real emotions that the father is experiencing. But and that is what these ceremonies are about. This is a mix of the fake and the authentic that lie together in a way that it becomes almost impossible to challenge the fake, right? So this is an interesting exchange for me, and I write about this in the book in some detail. This ability of the military to manufacture the authentic, I think, is central to how affect plays out in these ceremonies. It's important to understand the craft and the technology used to convey these images. So that's what this chapter tries to unpack.
The next chapter shifts the focus on these regimes of cultivating martial subjects, these very sort of rigorous regimes of cultivating a certain kind of a masculine martial subject. And you really do a very close, sort of ethnography of these processes. So I was wondering if you could share a bit with our listeners the kind of normative assumptions about class, about civility and masculinity that inform these processes of cultivating martial subjects. And the main argument of the chapter, as I read it, was that through these processes over time, there has been some kind of a social contract which has emerged or developed between soldiers and soldier families in Chakwal and then the military. So I was wondering if you could speak a bit about that larger argument also that comes up in this chapter.
Sure. I think one of the ways to understand and to answer your question is to really look at the primary drivers that push men into military service in Pakistan and maybe even all over the world. So I'll come back to Chakwal, but So we know, for example, that in Pakistan, at least, economic desperation is one thing that traditionally drives people towards the military, right? Soldiers are traditionally drawn from rural, poorer, less irrigated parts of Punjab, as well as certain districts of KP. And over time, the pool of districts that supply war labor has expanded, but the bulk of the soldier class continues to come from poorer rural households, right? And so side by side, we also have a more racial and ideologically driven image of the soldier from martial areas, which constructs, quote unquote, martial areas, which constructs these men as hardy, valiant, better equipped to handle the harsh army life and discipline. So military service, in addition to being like a source of livelihood, also becomes a mode to achieve or to aspire to masculine standards and warrior myths. So these kind of drivers are traditionally have been put out as the reasons for why men will join military. And if you add this to what I spoke about a little earlier in terms of the cultivation of certain districts for military labor and how over the years these districts have, you know, become specialized pools where the primary livelihood opportunity is the military. So if you add this in a way that this that becomes an explanation for why people from these areas continue and how markers of class and masculinity also play into that. But at the same time, I believe that there's also a politics to this construction. And so in this, I think in the next subsequent chapter, I look at, which is titled Manufacturing Soldiers, I look at training regimes. And I think what I'm trying to sort of put out there is that the soldier in the Pakistan army is not innately martial, nor is he simply socialized into martialness because of an accident of history or by appeals to ideals of masculinity or nationalism. I believe that's a reductive explanation because if you look at the training regimes within these institutions, the soldier is created in these institutions. The soldier that turns up for training may have his inculcation into martialness may be eased by his history or by him being because of him being a man, definitely. But very much these associations they definitely support his entry into martialness. But the real work of the construction of the soldier rests primarily within the military training institution, and this is something that the training in charge colonels and the majors that I interviewed were very, you know, very emphasized on, where the soldier is meticulously and exhaustively disciplined. And so there's the regimes of training are fascinating to look at in terms of how the soldier, which produced the soldier. And he's a careful product of the training institution, which uses modern techniques of discipline to exploit economic desperations. And these techniques build upon gendered and also racially tinted cultural frames to produce, docile subjects for the military, which can then fight for it or kill for it or die for it. So for me, it's just important to separate these, to give them their due, the history and the other aspects which contribute towards it, but I it's important for me to emphasize that this construction or this manufacture, as I call it, actually happens within the training institute.
Now, in the next chapter, you sort of return to the theme of grieving, and you again detail the sort of spectacles that are really choreographed in terms of how grieving for dead soldiers takes place in terms of how the military in some ways really organizes these expansive and massive funerals and so on. And again, a key theme that returns in this chapter also is that the scripted sort of push to frame the death of soldiers as a heroic martyrdom or shahadat is often in some tension with the visceral emotions of loss and regret that is experienced by the bereaved family. So could you again give an example of what these spectacles look like, how they're choreographed, and this tension that you so wonderfully capture in this chapter between the official script and the actual unfolding of grief among the families of the dead soldiers?
Mm-hmm. This is perhaps, I think, my most, it was the hardest chapter to write because of, I think, the content. I think what's, and also to research in some ways. I think this was a very heavy chapter for me personally, and It probably does stay the heaviest every time I do revisit the book. Here I talk about the death of the soldier and how it's received within villages. So this is no longer the public commemoration of grief. This inherently is much more private, and yet it is not, because the military is very much present. In fact, orchestrates the entire funeral within the village. And the rites that accompany the death of a soldier in the village space, from the point the family is notified, either through a telephone call or through somebody coming in and informing them, to the time that the coffin arrives, to the very elaborate funeral, till the moment the last military trucks actually leave, I saw them as a zigzag patchwork of deeply private moments of pain, interspersed with ritualistic, regulated grief that is performed. And this ritualization and regulation of grief is obviously enforced by the military, which is very much present in the funeral ceremony. Some examples of this is like matam, or mourning for the shaheed, is discouraged, right? And this is a religious trope as well. It is repeated by the village cleric, and it is actively appropriated by the military. So tears are especially discouraged. Despite, or perhaps because of it, when they spoke about their memories of the funeral, they spoke very much in the idiom of tears and crying. So Ved, which is like a Punjabi mourning ritual, which is where professional weepers, women, will talk about the person who's died and will cry and mourn and wail loudly, is something that is discouraged when it comes to military funerals. However, when I spoke to women, especially mothers, many of them sort of performed the Ven while they spoke of their sons, and they would do it often. So that was interesting for me, that this is a practice that the military says should not happen for shohadas, but this is something that women feel like they have. This is the way they express their grief. And the choice of the words in the Ven are also very significant, because they reflected an anger, a deep rejection of the narrative of meaningful deaths /shahadat, and some expressed the wish that the son had died when he was a child, when death for them would be less meaningful perhaps, but would be more acceptable and less painful. So in fact, I think the chapter begins with a Ven by a mother, which is very moving. So that's one example. I talk of other examples where, despite strict regulation, there are many moments when this discipline that is enforced by the military is almost defied. And I use the word defied carefully, because it gives this impression that there is some sort of open resistance. It's not. You have to look for this defiance, and you have to be sensitive to how this is expressed. So because it's defied in moments of extreme pain, it's defied through affect. So, for example, this mother spoke to me about, so often what happens is, if the soldier has died in action, sometimes the body is so mutilated that they don't want the family to see it. So what they will do is that they will gather the parts and they will put it into the coffin and nail it shut. And, touching somebody who has died, who you love, is an important process through which we say goodbye, right? Culturally also. And so for these women, a lot of these women who couldn't touch their sons who died was something that regret that they stayed with. And this particular woman spoke about how, in the middle of the night, because the coffin was in the house and because the funeral was to happen the next day and her husband was asleep, she went and she prized apart the lid and she opened the coffin and touched her son. It was obviously a very moving experience to listen to that, and how she sort of noted all the sutures and how the body was mutilated. And so in some ways... So these are moments where, because of what she felt at that moment, she felt that she wanted to risk censure or she was willing to then go against what the military had, clearly dictated, that nobody will open the coffin. In fact, they leave a person with the coffin normally so that nobody touches the coffin in the event that the funeral is on the next day. They don't leave the coffin alone. They guard it, so to speak. So, and other images in a video funeral that I was allowed, I was given access to, which was had been done in the village. Often these people will record these funerals, because these are very spectacular ceremonies, complete with military trucks and parades, and firing of the gun and the bugle horns and so on. So in this particular video funeral that I was watching, this man is the father of the deceased soldier sitting next to the open grave. The body has been lowered into the grave, and he's just crying. He's sobbing inconsolably, and at the same time, the camera is capturing all the sort of actions of what the military is doing in terms of the protocol of what follows, and the flag ceremony and the handing over of the cap, and so all of that is happening on the side, whereas the father himself is just crying, and so those are very so these scenes speak to the ambivalence where the family and villagers adhere to the military narratives, but through their affect they also in some ways defy them. They don't follow the rules that are set out by the military. And yet, however, they still read from these scripts, and this juncture allows for not a weakening but a reconsolidation of hegemonic power, because this I explain because from what I understood and from what I've analyzed, this is because the family narratives also speak about intense regret and deep guilt for sending their sons into the military in the first place and not being able to save them when they were deployed in combat. So this is not a sudden death. This is a death which is sort of happens in slow motion, because the son is posted to an area. The son will call and from time to time talk about what's happening. Will talk about the threat to his life. Will talk about his comrades dying. So this is these families live in dread. They know that phone call will come, and so this inability to have saved their sons, knowing that this was going to befall them, is something that a regret and a guilt that they live with. And so this reconsolidation or desire to cling to military scripts and narratives of sacrifice is almost a salve, really, a protection from not just external censure or fear of the military. It's almost like an internal censure. It's because it's very hard to face that. So it almost becomes a crutch that they need to hold on to process the grief that they're experiencing.
Right. In the next chapter, you focus on the practice of compensating families of dead soldiers and actually show how it's a very regulated sort of system in place in terms of the compensation schemes and so on. And there again, you discuss this really fascinating tension between, on the one hand, compensating families materially for their loss for the dead soldiers, and on the other hand, this narrative of framing death as this glorious martyrdom or shahadat and so on, how the material and the transcendent in some ways is interlocked in this tension that you really wonderfully tease out. So I was wondering if you could speak a bit about that argument. And then, of course, the second part of the argument of this chapter is some of the gendered assumptions or assumptions of patriarchy that inform these compensation schemes and rules, and what happens when the widow of a soldier remarries and what kinds of complications that generates. So I was wondering if you could speak a bit about both of these key themes of this chapter.
So this is, I think, this monetized aspect of military death. So this is a very imperceptible narrative that lies side by side with the much more amplified and louder narrative of glorious sacrifice and shahadat. And this imperceptibility or this invisibility of this narrative is for me was very intriguing, right? And so my contention of this being invisible comes from the fact that these ceremonies set out by the military to commemorate its martyrs rarely mention compensation. And this is in contrast to civilian compensations, which in the case of the government will make, there'll be a huge push to put out that this is what we are offering for civilians who die in terrorist attacks, or even for the police force, law enforcement agencies. The compensation policies are openly discussed. They're available on the net. They're available for people to contest also. So there's been contestation in terms of what's been given or it's not been given, or what is being given is not enough. But when it comes to military compensation, we don't have that kind of public discourse. So this invisibility was intriguing to me. So my question really is, why is this invisibility? Why does this invisibility exist, and why is it desired, and what purpose does it serve? So within the book, I put out that so the military is very keen to set up the sacrifice as non-compensationable, as something that cannot be compensated. And this is simply because if it is not compensated, so to speak, in some ways, its ability to be continuously appropriated by the military to command loyalty of its citizens remains, right? If something has been adequately compensated, although I know very well that death of a loved one can never be adequately compensated, but in terms of, but still, if something can be shown to have been compensated, so to speak, that is the politics of compensation, then in some ways, the debt has been paid. Whereas in this case, the military very much wants the nation to continue to pay this debt to the military. So I think that is one reason why these compensation regimes do not find, we don't really find them being openly discussed and they're deliberately put aside. The other is, I think, the fact that these compensation schemes in the military are more generous compared to what civilians are offered or what maybe even the police is offered. And not so much, it's not so much the substance of these compensations, it's also the mechanics which deliver them. So the military obviously has a specific way of delivering these emoluments. They're very predictable. There's a whole system whereby the beneficiaries of these schemes can, attach themselves to and then can be can receive what is offered, right? So in so many ways, this invisibility is also desired because there is that tension between what is offered to the military soldier is different from than what is, say, offered to a law enforcement personnel. Another reason for this tension also, I think, is or invisibility really, is the kind of tensions that underlie these regimes in the sense of this does happen where there are family discords as a result at the receiving end between beneficiaries. So if the emoluments were given to the wife who was young, who maybe went back to live with her parents or who decided to get married again, then there can be discord between families in terms of who gets to keep the money that was received or the piece of land that was received. So the military does not want these conflicts to be aired because in some ways it tarnishes this narrative of glorious, selfless sacrifice where money is, where the transactional part of it kind of interferes with that image, right? So that's, and that brings me to the second part of your question, which if I've understood what, I think So the military policy single out the female members of the household, women and wives and mothers, and so that's interesting. But it's actually reflective more of a patriarchal state that enforces what is a family ethic, where women are seen as dependents rather than an idea that or imagining that women are autonomous and therefore they need to be compensated. So they're seen as bebas or majboor or bichari, so, helpless, dependent widows who then need support and therefore they must be provided for. And unfortunately, despite the somewhat affirmative nature of the policy, it doesn't translate into real autonomy for women. In most cases, they end up being pawns between male members of the family. So from her own father's side, her brothers or fathers, and at the other side, in terms of the fathers and brothers of the deceased soldier. So she ends up getting pulled in different directions. In a lot of cases that I saw, women were then married off to the younger brother, or if he was not married at that point. And the idea very much being to keep the, whatever has been received in compensation within the family. So they end up, in some ways even more restricted and constrained within these regimes of compensation.
Now, the next chapter focuses on a very interesting theme and a much less visible theme. Actually, that is one of the major, an amazing part of this book, that so many of these themes that one sort of has a sense of, but it is not made visible. I think this book really makes visible all these really fascinating and many times harrowing details and processes. But anyways, this chapter, next chapter, focuses on the theme of the maimed soldiers, or soldiers who've lost their limbs and so on. And you showed sort of the military's anxiety over properly managing the representation of maimed soldiers. So I was wondering if you could speak a bit about what that anxiety looks like, how are they managed and represented, and again, what are some of the sort of gendered assumptions of masculinity and femininity that inform those representations and the process of those representations?
Yes, I think the question of the maimed or the disabled soldier is incredibly interesting, and it's something I personally felt like I wanted to spend more time on. And then, as often is the case with books, you just have to decide to leave some things out. So this is something that I'd like to produce more work on, because I personally believe that I haven't done it justice. And part of that is because I think when I originally went into the research, I wasn't looking for the maimed and the disabled soldier. This is a reality that I couldn't avoid when I went into the village space, where people pointed out to me that I should go meet so and so because he just returned from the war and he didn't have any legs, or so interestingly, I kind of stumbled upon this subject, and I did feel like I had to have him as part of the story. But again, just an acknowledgement that I don't think I've done it justice. But I'm glad it's put out some. It's intrigued you enough to want to talk about it, because maybe then in some ways there can be more work that can be done around it. So just to give you a context, again, in this war on this war in the northwest region of Pakistan, we have a very large number of disabled soldiers, largely because of the improvised explosive devices, IED, that has been used in this kind of warfare. So you have three kinds of injuries. You have spinal cord injuries, you have traumatic brain injuries, and you have the most common, which is amputations, right? So amputation of one, two, or sometimes three limbs. So despite this high number of this disablement, despite this, the Shaheed is far more visible in nationalist discourse around this war. And so military narratives are clearly wanting to, and they do assimilate the able-bodied soldier and the dead soldier, but they kind of tend to erase or disregard the maimed or the incomplete bodies, which are also a cost of war, right? So again, the question is why, and why is it so much harder for the military to bring them into this? So in the Yom-e-Shohadas that I spoke about earlier, we have glimpses of them. So every now and then in one or two events, in one or two of these shows, they have dedicated, say, a video documentary, or they've invited one or two disabled soldiers onto the stage itself. But in more often than not, they tend to be relegated to one side of the audience, where the camera does capture them and there's a mention made of them, but clearly the Shaheed and his sacrifice is far more central to this whole commemoration of sacrifice. So one, I think the discomfort in placing the main body in these narratives of war is the anxiety, as you just said, of the military to in any meaningful way place it within this discourse. And that comes, I believe, because the military is very much about, if you look at military, the aspiration very much is for the perfection of the physical, right? So you have these perfect physical bodies that even for entry into the military, you have physical measurements, you have very grueling physical exams that they have to be taken. So the body and its ability to be fit and to be perfect, so to speak, is a central trope within military service, right? And literally the body, and I say literally, is paraded, right, to show strength and discipline. So you have these military parades. It becomes very difficult for the military to use these incomplete bodies that are no longer symbols of brave, well, no longer symbols of strength in some ways, strength as defined by the military at least. And they're almost feminized in their dependency. So these are bodies that can no longer look after you, guard you, protect you. In fact, these are bodies that need to be guarded and need to be protected and need to be looked after, or what I call feminized bodies. So, and the kind of affect that they will inspire in others is not necessarily adulation, which is what the military wants, but it is going to be more of almost pity. So in that way, it becomes these bodies are really the antithesis of what the military stands for. So how does it, so it really struggles with how to bring these bodies into this discourse. And another aspect why I think that there are tensions with regards to how the military looks at disablement and named soldiers is the fact that these are also bodies that are still in a position to speak, right? And this sounds, as opposed to the body that's died, right, which is nailed shut in a coffin, and you can then speak for that dead body, whereas these bodies can speak and articulate their own version of suffering. And it's a very different kind of suffering. Death is final. This is a continuous suffering in a society like Pakistan, where disablement remains a huge stigma. So this is a military soldier between ages of 17, 23, who returns to his village as a disabled person in a setting which doesn't look very kindly upon this kind of disablement. So there's initial sympathy, and then after some time, you are basically discarded from everyday living. So often these people will have their, break up. If they're engaged, their engagements can break up. Sometimes marriages break up. So there's a lot of, there's a huge toll on the disabled soldier beyond the actual disablement itself. So this suffering can be articulated very differently. And so they're unpredictable bodies, they're precarious bodies for the military to look. And heroism and sacrifice is easier, right, to paint on the body of the dead. So it's an anomalous category which occupies a space between the living and the dead. And I think in that it presents it's a challenge for the military in terms of how it can use it within its discourse. And I think at this point, we are still struggling with that. In time, the military may become sophisticated enough to be able to include them in this narrative in more unquote meaningful ways. But at this point, they do present they're looked upon with some tension.
Now, in the final substantive chapter of the book, and I think this is a chapter that will be of particular interest. I mean, all of the chapters will be, but this one will be of particular interest to students and scholars of Islamic studies. You talk about the ambiguities and tensions surrounding the military's appropriation of jihad and martyrdom or shahadat, and how that becomes particularly ambiguous in the context of the war on terror, where you have competing claimants to these categories of jihad and martyrdom and so on, in the context of the especially the operations in Waziristan and the border regions between Afghanistan and Pakistan and so on. So that was one key aspect of this chapter that would be great if you could speak about. And then, of course, the second part of the chapter, you talk about how these tensions are reflected in the military's training centers and also among clerics or sort of religious figures of competing normative persuasions or ideological groups that are prominent in South Asia more broadly, but are also quite operative in Chakwal. So I was wondering if you would combine these two segments of this chapter.
That's a pretty heavy question. I'm going to try. And then I hope those who are interested will actually get a chance to read the chapter in more detail. But so since 9/11, the Pakistani military has grappled with the new enemy system. So it is fighting a war inside Pakistan's borders against an enemy that is not yet othered and whose religious faith is uncomfortably familiar. So, and as a result, initial support for this war was lukewarm at best, right? And the contestations, there were a number of contestations that were made public, including actual religious fatwas against the military. And talking more about the early period of this war, so there was growing unease among troops as well. There was reports of desertion, especially as military deployments grew in these areas and became more intense, and more importantly, as soldiers started to die. So in a way, this has not been an easy war for Pakistan, and support for it has been difficult for the military to garner. So how does this unease then become reflected within the spaces where the military sort of claims its subjects, yeah, recruitment grounds for military labor? And that is the question that I am trying to answer within this chapter. So the discomfort and anxiety around those who die fighting in this war is never articulated outright, in an outright manner. But what I found was that it was quantified as a comparison with earlier Shaheeds. Yeah. So to explain that, so villagers would refer to those who fought and died in wars on the Indian border or on the Siachen Glacier as the Asal Shaheed, quote unquote, the real martyrs, implying but never stating, saying all outright that the Shaheeds returning from Swat or Waziristan are not as real. So it's an important distinction. It's a nuanced sort of articulation. So I'm not saying that they don't think that these people are Shaheed, but they have created this hierarchy to express this discomfort at the same time, right? So the dead in this war continue to be referred as Shaheed, but are differentiated from those who die fighting against the real enemy, which is, of course, in Hindu India. So there's a distinction here, but yet there is a hierarchy, and yet there is a discomfort that's expressed. And so the question of clerics, I'm not going to be able to do justice to the question you just asked, but I just mention it briefly. So that's a very interesting figure. And I pick on the figure of the cleric or the khatib at two points in the book. One is as within the training center and one within these local spaces that I interrogate. So within the training center, in terms of the military, since General Zia's time, we've had clerics who have been inducted into the military through a formal recruitment process. Yeah. And so he's regularized the position. And he's often, it's often said that he's responsible for the Islamization of the army. But it's interesting, in some ways, what it has done is that this figure is actually brought this figure under control of the military. So the way this works is that this figure within the training institute is clearly subservient to army hierarchy, is subject to the same rules and regulations that govern other army soldiers and officers. So it can be court-martialed, for example, can be punished, his emoluments, his pension, his salary can be taken away, and he can be strictly disciplined to suit the needs of the institution. So in a way, his regularization actually is enables him to become subservient to the military, and he becomes much more of a religious mascot as opposed to a spiritual leader. So in this within the institution, I see that the role of the cleric for me remains very much subservient, to the point that in the awareness and motivation course, which is taught to new recruits, where a large section of it deals with Islam and Islam's history, that is not taught by the cleric or the khatib who is hired and inducted and present within the training. It's taught by regular JCOs and NCOs. So that was interesting for me as to somebody, and because this khatib is educated, he's got a master's degree in religion, in Islam, but he's not considered appropriate for teaching that. So his role is very much in the masjid, to do with five time prayers or to give motivating lectures on, what the military sees fit in terms of religious education. So that's one side. The other is the cleric within the local terrain, which I think is what you were referring to, which is this cleric obviously has much more room to maneuver. And although here too, he's appropriated at the time of the funeral, the military will come and meet him and he will be told the sermon that he gives at the janaza or at the funeral will be something that will be discussed in depth with him. But within local commemorations, for example, so local annual anniversaries of soldier deaths that are held in these villages, so they will give sermons at the time of prayer. So they have more room to maneuver and more room to sometimes express some ambivalences that I've hinted at before regarding this war. So in this particular village, there was a Deobandi Maulvi, and he spoke at this annual commemoration anniversary of the soldier who died in Swat, I think. And he gave like a 40-minute lecture on Shahadat, and along with his regular sermon, he gave this long lecture on Shahadat, and he didn't mention the Pakistan state even once. So he spoke about Islam and the tradition of Shahadat, Islamic history, Islamic battle history, but he never spoke about Pakistan. So that I found interesting. So in a way, he was able to commemorate the soldier without necessarily bringing in the state. So that's an example of these ambivalences that exist in these local spaces.
So as a final substantive question, Maria, I was wondering if you can just take a step back a bit And if you could share with our listeners a bit about what would be sort of the two central conceptual or political sort of take-home points that you would want readers to take away from this project regarding what I saw as the three key categories of militarism, affect, and the citizenry. What would be sort of the two take-home points that you would want readers to take away from this book?
Okay. I think one would be simply an appreciation of this kind of study of militarism. So a study that moves away from grand narratives and explanation of militarism in very structural, historical, political, economic contexts, which really dominate this subject. And I'm not at all saying that these are not important. Yes, they are, and they're very, very important, and they have to frame militarism itself. But I do believe that there is more to understanding how militarism operates, and that recording the experiences and motivations of foot soldiers, those who die, and those who let their loved ones die, referring to families, it really opens up more intimate routes through which to study the project of militarism. And this, I believe, is really not just a theoretical exercise. I believe it's a political exercise, and I'll explain that. Because I think the focus on the affective domain represents a very much needed sort of a way to understand how militaristic narratives of sacrifice and service to the nation have valence within population. It tells us something very important theoretically about how hegemonic power operates to make us subjects through the technology of affect, right? So that's the central theme. How does the technology of affect operate to make us complicit subjects? And so by attending to this technology, we are able to glimpse also not just the complicity, but also the disjunctures between the hegemonic project and its reception at the local level, which are cracks that are allowed only through the expression of affect. Yeah. So for me, therefore, this focus on affect is important to understand hegemonic power and its operation and how it is challenged, how challenge is inherent within how this subject position is created. And also sort of a focus on affective domain enables us, and that's the political point that I hope readers are able to take away from this book, is that a focus on this affective domain enables us to understand how affect associated with military death can act as a formidable deterrent to any challenge or to questioning of the militarism project. So I'm going to go back to what I started this discussion with you today, which was about the soldiers who died in the Siachen at the Siachen Glacier as a result of this avalanche, where there was such an outpouring of grief and solidarity with the families who'd lost their sons and or husbands that we were not able to question the war itself. Yeah, because questioning the war effort seemed almost as if we were questioning this very real grief that these people were experiencing. So this ability of affect to stifle dissent, whether among the direct subjects of militarism or within citizenry, is important to recognize, right? So an investigation of anti-war activism, if anybody's interested, will show that criticism is often weakened by a desire to show respect for the families of the deceased and sentiments of soldiers, right? And even when state policies have led the combat certain combats to have been challenged, or when movements are fueled by a realization of the unjustness or meaninglessness of war, limits are placed on these critiques by an emotional pull which demands that even if we protest against the war, we must support the soldiers, if not the war itself, right? And so there's a concurrent reverence of troops. And it is this constructed heroism that we need to challenge, yeah? And it can be a challenged it can be a challenge that can be made all the more potent if we really understand how affect operates within this. So for me, that's a very important takeaway for the, you know, I hope that readers can sort of take that message and take that into their understanding of how these wars are made possible around us.
So as we're coming to the end of our time, Maria, could you please share with our listeners a bit what you are planning as possibly your next project?
Oh, that's a hard, that's probably the hardest question that you asked me so far. Because, I mean, I think one, simply because in the times that we're living in currently, it's just so hard to plan, to have any long-term plan, because everything seems very fragile. So, but in terms of my own scholarly interests, I think definitely I will continue along the lines of this book. And so some ideas that I'm toying with in my head is doing some more comparative work, which looks at what I've done and sort of looks at other nation states to understand if how these dynamics play out there. And not so much to look for differences as often is the case with comparative work, but really to look for similarities. Because for me, it's an important political project to point out that militarism is something that has more in common globally as a project of the military, as opposed to what we'd like to believe that it's a nationalist project and therefore particular to certain countries or nuanced by certain histories, which of course is true, but I think it's important to be able to identify how global this project is and how the modern, very modern institution of the military operates in very similar ways across very disparate cultural milieus and histories. So for me, that's an interesting project to explore. I have no idea how I'm going to do that, but yeah. That's something that I think about from time to time.
Dying to Serve: Militarism, Affect, and the Politics of Sacrifice in the Pakistan Army by Maria Rashid, published by Stanford University Press in 2020 as part of the South Asia in Motion series at Stanford. So thank you so much, Maria, for your time, for this wonderful conversation, and for such an incredible book that I'm sure will spark multiple conversations across different fields. So I really appreciate this phenomenal book and your coming on the New Books Network to chat with us.
Thank you, Sherilee.